What's the first memory? What's the first thing you can remember happening to you in your whole life?
I think it's learning to crawl. I think I was in Sri Lanka and my mum was putting cheesy Watsits in front of me and I was crawling to get them and eat them.
Are you aware of your visual imagination? That secret cinema in your head that no one else in the world can see? When you hear this noise, it's a trigger to say, see anything? See anything?
I see a village in the Alps.
Sheep or goats with bells around their necks.
All his sheep around.
Clanging, it's cows. It's
all dish man.
Asian country. Someone's chopping some wood.
Sweaty and topless.
Like a guy whacking his head with a Bible.
He's quite wrinkled in the face, quite tanned, and he lives outside.
Maybe chopping a tree down.
Maybe Heidi, actually. Maybe not Asian.
That's like an Italian goat
green
herd.
Green pastures. Splitting.
He had a beard, a hat on.
Cows disappearing.
I can see someone chopping wood. A tree.
The tree's falling there. The tree's fallen down.
Wiping their brow.
Quite a densely populated wood.
A lot of light that comes through across the
glowing on the edge of his axe.
So I could describe to you what I was seeing, but whether I was actually seeing... I can see a snowy landscape. Maybe
I could draw it
with huskies and harnesses.
I could draw what I imagined it to be like.
Lots
and
of
the breaking of ice and a load of ice.
Someone arriving on some kind of sled. And lots of things attached.
Piece of ice that was the only thing holding an avalanche. From
again, very weathered and much younger. His clothes
condition.
Are
kind of galloping and this
sort
guy going
old clothes.
And I had no idea what that
very
was.
Very strong.
See a giant knocking at
weirdly
a massive
beating
door.
A big empty oil drum at the end.
Maybe he's in a
German
Russian outfit or a Polish outfit. One of them's got a whip.
That's
it's all fairly surreal.
A huge
and from the two big doors on either side of the big shed.
Cowards.
And now they're running
straw
up and down
everywhere and
having a race.
And at the end, you see a girl coming through.
Cows mooing
cows
all over the place, and I felt like I was in the middle of a field of longhorn cows.
Very beautiful, big breasts and lovely hair. Brown,
bearded
hair,
people
in
big
fur jackets with crisscross shoes on.
Some people see bright, vivid and very specific visions.
I'm the director of a fundraising department.
My name is
for a charity.
Luca Ewan Goodfellow and... I go
Hello,
to
my
school.
Name's Ford Hickson. I am a assistant professor at the London School of Hygiene and
my
Tropical
name's
Medicine.
My name's Emma. I live in Brighton and
Ian
I'm
Goodfellow.
A performer and a writer.
I'm an architect.
Hello, Matt. I'm Michael Bywater. I'm a writer.
I'm Francesca.
My name's Danny Webb and I am a, well, kind of handyman, painter and decorator,
I'm
DJ
Susan
and
Aldworth, and I'm an artist.
That's it, generally, other than that bit of house.
Some people see bright, vivid and very specific visions. Some people see nothing at all.
I'm Nick Watkins. I'm trained as a theoretical physicist.
I'm Jill Morgan. I spent 4 years as the permanent secretary to the Welsh Government. But I'm a doctor by original training.
I went from there into space physics and from there into the physics of the Earth's environment.
In my late 20s, I was doing some management development, and one of the things that they asked us to do was imagine a beautiful dawn. It's part of relaxation, you know, it's a normal sort of thing.
See anything?
And I thought, dawn? Imagine it? Well, I know what a dawn is. I know there are lights in the sky and I can tell you it's pink. But I couldn't imagine, I couldn't see this thing. So afterwards I said to everybody, well, what did you see when you did the dawn? And they all said, oh, these glorious pictures, I could see a coming light. And I'm thinking, yeah, because I've seen dawns and I remember seeing them, but I can't recollect inside my head the actual visual process of seeing a beautiful dawn. It had never occurred to me that people could actually conjure a face in their mind.
It was in very late 1997, and I was reading the Sunday Independent. I was reading Michael Bywater, their great columnist, and he had an article with the brilliant title of How to Have Fun Without Taking Your Clothes Off. Just a couple of sentences, really, to give you the flavour. He kicked off with, time is an illusion, but you can never tell what's going to do the trick. You don't believe me? Ask any theoretical physicist, or better still, an actual physicist, if you can find one. Time, he will tell you, it's just an illusion, but he won't tell you about the trick, because he doesn't know what it is. If he did, he wouldn't be futzing around being a physicist. He'd open a business and get rich.
Time rolled back while you wait. Easy terms for pensioners and the unwaged.
He then goes on to talk about the process of memory, and he says, I know, I've been there, not the past, everyone's been there, worse than Ibiza. No, I mean that state of mind where the past is not just a collection of memories, but a sanctuary, and you strive to get back there, and you can't. And by the end of the first column, when he said, begin the process of rolling time back, you choose a memory, focus on it, let the rest of the mind go blank, and wait.
This time of year, from September to Christmas, it's particularly rich in memorial stimuli. Move on, autumn evenings, heavy with mist and leaf mould. Old farts coughing on the bus, tyres shushing on the wet streets, the lights on in the shop windows, and the girl you were hoping to see is snogging someone else.
I think I had realised that that he was describing something rather different from my experience.
I can't see pictures in my head. I don't have a mind's eye, is how I'd now articulate it.
It became obvious to me that the mind's eye was not a figure of speech. Phrases like, it takes you back, and so forth, they exist because they capture something that most people do.
So if I were to ask you to tell me a story from your last holiday or something about last Christmas.
I remember going to Clacton. I was thinking about this the other day, so...
It's very likely that as you did so, you would visualise a scene.
Could you tell me your very first memory?
I can't do what Bywater describes, as it were, the reassuring process of going back to the past and feeling all its emotions or what have you.
I bought a helium balloon. I came home clutching the balloon still and went out into the garden, thought, actually, I'd need to nip to the loo, and I let it go. When I came back, it was just like a little dot in the sky, and I sobbed.
I think for
hours.
Most of us, visual imagery is an important constituent of autobiographical memory.
Could you tell me your very first memory?
Just seeing it kind of drifting and floating.
I honestly can't tell you.
And my dad was watering the garden at that point.
The moon was silver. It was a very, very dark sky. My mother had on a red shirt.
I can remember him standing next to me.
I was snuggled into her arms, and we were looking through window with 8 panes of glass, and there were some curtains.
I have a memory of being lifted by my mum in her arms. No idea where I was.
I think I was sitting in a small metal bath on a hill on the west coast of Scotland, looking out over a sea loch below.
And can you see that now?
I can. A bath
it's
was
more a kind of colour.
Just a bit bigger than my body.
I can't give you the first one. I could give you an example of something I do remember about being a child, but I can't say, for example, as say my partner can, I remember sitting in a, you know, the lid of an upturned sewing machine when I was 6 or something like that. I can't actually do that.
And I could see my mother and I could see my brother
sitting in my pram in the garden, aged about,
very beautiful sunny
I suppose, 9 months, and hearing the wind making the hood of the pram sort of with that thing. That was the first thing I remember.
My very, very first memory is being up on a mountain with my father, and my father helping me walk across a gully on a pipe, which felt enormous to me but was very small to him.
And can you see that? Can you picture that scene?
No.
So how do you know you've got that memory?
It's a memory that I can make up from, tell myself a story, really.
I think my earliest memory is a step onto a rather high step, because I would have been very little at the time, it seemed very high, onto a train in Portugal, which had just been mildly derailed. So it was quite an exciting event, and I was with my grandparents.
One of the other people who was part of the Canadian study, I would say she has an even starker experience than mine, because she talks about having to, or as a child, inventing stories or inventing a past to talk about it. And I think it's partly what happens if you're very aware of this much younger than I was, whereas I was not aware of not having as much of a story, perhaps, being stored as other people. So it didn't matter at the time.
Well, very early memories are very fragmentary and slightly suspect, aren't they?
See anything?
So, my name is Adam Zeman, and my title is Professor of Cognitive and Behavioural Neurology at the University of Exeter Medical School.
I shared a bedroom with my brother, and it's probably being in bed.
And my research focuses are, more recently, disorders of visual imagery. I hadn't, until I encountered a particular patient, been aware at all of the existence of disorders of visual imagery.
And I dreamt about the cupboard being full of toys.
But a little over 10 years ago, when I worked in Edinburgh, a colleague of mine passed me a letter and said, Adam, I think this is your sort of thing. And it was a letter referring a man who had undergone a procedure on his heart, a coronary angioplasty, following which he'd become aware that he was no longer able to visualise, no longer able to summon imagery to the mind's eye.
Be that cupboard that I would open, it was on four legs, it had a little...
Who up till then had enjoyed a very vivid visual imagination. He used to think of places he'd visited and the faces of friends and family as he was dropping off to sleep.
I guess if I think about the floor or the walls, I fill it in. I'm not remembering what they are.
And he found that after this procedure, he was no longer able to summon imagery deliberately to the mind's eye. And he said that he had lost his visual enjoyment of fiction. And over the next few years, I had a series of contacts independently from over 20 people saying...
Described perfectly what I'd experienced all my life.
I'm just like this guy, but I always have been. I've never been able to visualise. I've never been able to summon imagery to the mind's eye.
Because my son doesn't have a visual memory either. And I don't think my mother did either, because if you ask my mother, what does a horse look like? Neither she nor I would know when we were trying to draw something what the characteristics of a horse are compared to a cow or a pig. Well, we know horses are taller. Well, I know pigs have got big fatter noses and things, but we wouldn't be able to distinguish in drawing from our memory what the differences were. As soon as we see them, you know, we're not out in the street saying, good God, is that a pig or a cow or a horse? Because you know instantly. But trying to translate that into a drawing... The family is completely...
We looked into the background literature and found that, in fact, Francis Galton, who was a 19th century psychologist...
Francis Galton, July 1880.
...recognised, towards the end of the 19th century, that there was a group of people who appeared to lack visual imagery.
...the different degrees of vividness with which...
He was the first person to devise a questionnaire to measure the vividness of visual imagery, and he recognised that a small proportion of people seemed to lack it altogether.
The first questions that I put referred to the illumination... definition and colouring of the mental image, and they were framed as follows. Think of some definite object. Suppose it is your breakfast table as you sat down to it this morning.
Can you picture it?
And consider carefully the picture that rises before your mind's eye. 1. Illumination. Is the image dim or clear? 2. Definition. Are all the objects pretty well defined? 3. Colouring. Are the colours of the china, the toast, bread crust, mustard meat,
I had porridge with dates, honey and banana.
What did you have for breakfast this morning?
I didn't have breakfast, I'm very bad.
I was sitting in a cafe on a wooden bench, sitting opposite a good friend whose birthday it was.
Yesterday morning.
I didn't have breakfast yesterday morning, I'm very bad.
The room's very airy, it's quite noisy. It was very sunny, so it was quite golden.
So we weren't the first to recognise the phenomenon. For some reason, no one had investigated it in any detail over the following 100 years or so.
My son was sat to my left. There was a newspaper.
The first results of my inquiry amazed me.
Today I had two Weetabix and a little bit of sugar.
Many men, and yet a larger number of women, and many boys and girls, declared that they habitually saw mental imagery, and that it was perfectly distinct to them and full of colour.
Yeah. Oh, the black pudding, the skin slightly crinkling, you know?
Where are you seeing it in your head? Have you got any sense of where this picture is in your head?
No, I don't really. I don't think it's in a specific picture place. I just feel it. I kind of see it as I'm describing it. It's going round in there, almost on like a little, one of those little carousels that they used to look through in the Victorian times. I suppose like one of those spinning round.
A Canadian brain scientist called Endel Tulving has christened it mental time travel. He's postulated that only human beings can have the subjective experience of moving themselves back and forward in time.
See, apart from seeing Josanne Wood very clearly, because she was the girl I was hoping to see, I can't remember whether she was snogging someone else. Probably
it's
not.
A very interesting, provocative claim that it's a sort of echt human ability to project yourself back and forward in time and have this subjective feeling that you're in the past.
But I can see very, very clearly the poles and the sparks of the old trolley bus.
It's what most people call mental pictures, the mind's eye. It's the interesting bit, if you like, when people talk about imagination, it's what most people find interesting about the term imagination. Whereas the memory side is what I was to learn was christened episodic memory.
I can see the water on the wet stone. I can see the dirt on the tyres of the trolley.
You know, I'm as much the product of the past as anybody else. It's just that I don't subjectively go back there in the way that Bywater described.
Sort of where my third eye is, front top. But very often it is in its own space, which is curious, more like a hologram.
Lots of people from the interior of our country that come to witness rains in Goa, because they don't have rains like the type that we have in Goa. Rain in Goa is something unique for me. It rains.
See anything?
Immediately makes you think of being in a hotel in Cochin, looking out the window, and it was tipping it down.
Lovely cafe in Goa, lovely smells and loads of colours, delicious.
We drove out into the countryside to have a look at some of the paddy fields, so I'm imagining what he's describing, but I'm drawing on my own stock of images similar to what he's talking about, rather than inventing something, which is what I do when I read novels.
I see the monsoons, I see the water.
So we began writing up a description of these folk who'd been in touch with us because they had never been able to visualise, and we thought that their absence of imagery needed a name.
I saw something else. Let's go.
So I consulted a friend, a classicist friend, and he suggested the term aphantasia. Fantasia being Aristotle's term for the mind's eye, and the A denoting its absence. So that's how aphantasia came about.
If you venture out in the night after 11 o'clock and take a drive around the countryside, you'll find a lot of youngsters, basically boys,
filling with water to the point that they become rivers.
The rain. It's a funny thing, the way you imagine when you, because you also, from your memory,
a covered area on a boat,
bring up being caught in the very, very heavy rain. So you see it, you see how the countryside might get. You also remember the feeling of being absolutely wet through when you're caught out in that rain. I was in the Peak District last week, and that sort of rain, you felt like you're soaked through to beyond your skin.
The restaurants so faded away. Now sparkling.
Paddy fields. I've been in quite a lot of paddy fields.
Wet.
I've been in Goa. Banana leaves, water.
Looking out at the countryside.
All this rain.
Through the water.
Bouncing
the
off the banana leaves.
That I'm feeling.
Big banana
dry,
leaves, like big, big umbrella.
Strong.
People walking around.
Of wet
dark
ground,
day.
Wet green all around.
As it's getting towards night time.
When you see a frog, what do?
We just take the torch. A frog in the dark.
Banana leaves.
Two little eyes.
Water running off.
Staring.
Beautiful green.
At a torch.
Frog getting nervous? I mean, does it move around?
It doesn't. It just tries to move around, but once a torch is there, like his eyes are transfixed. Sort of.
green.
And then you go closer, closer. One person goes behind and jumps on it.
Jumps on it.
Yeah. See lots of images. Yeah. And
how do you kill the frog?
We cut off the neck.
Oh.
You want a demonstration?
you cut off the head.
Beheading the frogs. And then throw it on the fire. Yeah. All sorts of strange memories there. I thought about guillotining because frogs reminded me of
a lot of blood. The French eating frogs, throwing the head in the fire. You can see this big fire. I thought about Marie Antoinette and all that shiny skin in the rain. I began to imagine what the
quite a big frog.
Artery slightly bigger than my hand, maybe.
Anatomical structure of the frog might
be Indian, dark skinned. People that can have the agility to jump on the frog and grab it in the paddy so quickly. And up to my ankles in water shining back from the torches.
Rows and rows of
and the
frogs
moon
blinking
and all that green
in bow ties.
Black. Right, we're starting the search now.
I'm thinking about rolling my trousers up, even though I'm not in the water.
And there's a great chorus of frog music coming out of that, and I've got a horrible feeling that's where we're going, actually.
Getting a real sense of
very British man.
The darkness
and
of that.
He
and the,
is a bit
the mud
out of its depth
and his descent
he's
down.
He's not moving particularly comfortably.
It feels like it's all by lamplight.
Reminded me even
and
of
in the mud
scenes of Tarkovsky well, okay, film, small, Andrei Rublev.
You see the flies and
trying to make a big bell.
His clothes all stuck to
right, him. Moisture in the light from the lamp.
A frog with shimmering eyes.
You can't quite tell where you are and where everything is.
Somebody stamping on
dark shadows in the distance.
We've just met a man with... My goodness me, how many have you got there?
And he's almost lassoed the frog.
You can almost see the flashlight swaying across the...
Victorian paintings, it's lamp
across the land looking for the toads.
There's a very large pale one.
Yes.
Why aren't they...
And the look of terror on these little frogs' faces, so I was aware of seeing frogs. Been inland in Goa, I haven't been in a paddy field during the monsoon,
do
I don't
go
think.
Out to eat frog?
Yeah, but very few can afford it. I mean, if they go and buy in a restaurant. And most of them get scared to go and catch it because of the snakes.
Oh, now that we've finished, you tell us about the snakes. Thank you very much.
The Englishman who's talking, being bitten by a snake.
See a big falling
but
on the ground.
Big
knot,
screaming.
A writhing knot of snakes. Just below the surface of the water.
And all the Indian guys running over. Dinner. One of them actually grabs the snake.
I imagine somebody stamping on a frog.
Just by using one of those forked sticks.
But I saw the person catch the frog in my imagination. And I didn't see them cut off the frog's head, but I saw inside and I imagined it would have green blood rather than red blood.
I'm less interested in painting, for example, than some people might be.
It's a bit like Apocalypse Now.
But I'm a lot more interested in visionary filmmakers, for example, like Greenaway or Kubrick or Tarkovsky, or, you know, speak to me very much.
It was the bulbous eyes thing I was thinking of. I know Malcolm McDowell from Clockwork Orange.
And I seem to remember reading that Antonioni sent a telex or something to Kubrick when he saw 2001 saying, "You've made me dream with my eyes wide open." And I think that is the quality that a film like that manages to have.
It's like a dream, really. It was in colour, but it doesn't extend all the way to the edges. So I'm kind of seeing a... I'm a seeing, yeah. Saying it's seeing is a metaphor for it, really, because it's not like seeing, it's a different...
Very, very quickly, I think, I came across the famous paper on visual imagination by Francis Galton. The difference is that Galton's focus, and many of the people who followed him, was what we call the mind's eye. It's the ability that most people report, and remember, I'm taking this... You know, I'm taking other people's word for this, to actually see direct visual sensation in their heads with their eyes shut.
Our patient, who we called MX, was in all other respects, neuropsychological, neuropsychiatric respects, he was normal. He couldn't find anything amiss apart from the reported absence of visual imagery. So in the end, we performed a functional magnetic resonance imaging study to see what was unusual, if anything, about his brain when he tried to visualise.
Tolving's group, and the group in Baycrest, they did a bunch of tests. So it was things like show you a figure and see how well you remember it, asking you about your recent past and your distant past, and again getting friends and family to describe what they remember of the same event.
And we showed that when he looked at famous faces, he had completely normal brain activation, just like yours or mine. But when he tried to visualise them, he failed to activate visual areas towards the back of the brain, which you or I would activate.
They did fMRI, they did EEG, the sort of famous electrodes on the scalp. They did something like a week's worth of testing.
Quite a large subgroup of people with aphantasia, because I should say that now about 7,000 or 8,000 people have been in touch with me, as against the 20 who we initially reported. Quite a large subgroup describe having a thin or impoverished autobiographical memory.
What about family photograph albums?
Yeah, they matter. Yeah, I mean, I have made a conscious effort to acquire more of my past than I would have looked after.
I have photograph albums, and I can remember when I look at the photo how we felt and what the weather was like and who was being stroppy that day. So I can remember it all. And the photo is a trigger, but I can't bring a picture up in my head of me and my sisters on a rock.
But at least conceptually, imagery and memory are distinct.
There's also other relics, like, I mean, I was very, very interested in space as a child, and I kept these scrapbooks for the best part of 10 years. You know, they had little drawings in them and so forth, and those have become incredibly precious to me because I can't look at them and say I know how it felt to be there, but it's the next best thing. You know, in some sense, the thing stands in for the memory.
The ancient Greeks believed the future was behind us, and we went through life looking at the past, which is how we knew it so accurately and precisely, but advancing backwards into the future, which is why we couldn't quite tell what would happen.
So I think the relationship between memory and imagery is a very complex one that needs to be further teased out.
But equally, I'm not haunted by
Jim Friedel in Hoboken
past trauma in the way that clearly some people can be.
Directly, perhaps purposefully, into
One of the more vivid instances of that for me was, say, 9/11, when I talked to Americans who for days were kind of seeing the towers fall in their minds, you know, that as people will, you know, and I think at that point it was one of the first things to really bring home to me, you know, what the downside of recall is.
See anything?
But if somebody says 9/11, I can describe what I saw. I remember that the plane was going in, I remember the towers were falling, so I can describe it to you, but I remember it as a story, not as a picture.
Do you ever feel that you've missed out on something or that you are?
Only since my mum died. I've had conversations with people who talk about the death of their mum, and they talk about how they can conjure her face. I can't conjure my mum's face. That is a sadness.
We experience the past in the absence of recollection. You know, it's like the hummingbird that allegedly doesn't know that it can't fly. You know, if you don't tell it, it'll carry on flying. It's only if you tell it that it might worry, you know. In all other respects, we experience the same past that everybody else does. We just don't go there.